This ROFM podcast was brought to you with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Right, hello New Zealand and welcome to another episode of Turn the Page. My name's Mark Pacey from Wired Up Archive. Today we're taking you through three more stories from our past. Starting off, BMX or bicycle motocross started out with young enthusiasts riding their bikes on motocross tracks in Southern California in the early 1970s. By the early 1980s, it had a massive following, and BMX was the preferred bike of choice for kids and even olden teenagers and adults taking a keen interest. In almost every movie or television series from the 1980s, the preferred mode of transport for kids was the BMX bike. From The Goonies to Stranger Things, the BMX was synonymous with two-wheeled transport for the young ones. With interest growing in the country, Masterton did its part to be involved. In 1981, the Central League BMX Association first spring championship race was held here. In the lead-up to the newspapers, they ran several pages covering all things BMX. A safety checklist featured prominently, in which it covered the 10 points that should be checked before riding, which included brakes, handlebars, cables, nuts, and the seat, all adjusted for the rider's specifications. The local bike vendors also saw the supplementary pages as a wonderful opportunity to advertise their wares, each advert accompanied by an action shot of a rider mid-air. At 9 a.m. on November 15, the event started, officially opened by Mayor Cody. On that day, over 400 BMX riders from Manawatu, Whanganui, Wellington, Waipawa and Wairarapa converged on Queen Elizabeth Park in Masterton. Hosted by the Central Wairarapa BMX Club, the day consisted of over 200 events. There were three qualifying races, one semi-final race for the top 12 riders, and a final for the remaining six. The course was set depending on the riders. While there were adult riders up to the age of 24, there was a junior track for riders that were 20 years younger. There was also a race and a course for girls to compete in. There was even a side hack race, which had a BMX rider with a sidecar and a passenger. This race was not for the faint-hearted, and only the fittest of the riders would be able to keep up with the pace and the demands of the track. For any mishaps that occurred during the day, St. John were on hand to deal with any injuries. The Masterton track had been built to a high standard, and it was hoped that success of this race and other events and national championships would be held in Masterton. As the day progressed, the numbers of competitors dwindled and the top riders fought it out for the remaining places. While there were riders from all over the country taking part, including the capital, the local riders proved they could BMX with the best of them. Central Wairarapa rider Lee Stephen made it to the group final, where he finished in a very respectable third place. When the Nationals rolled in around 1982, Auckland landed the chance to host them. In that same year, there were over 70 BMX tracks around the country. 2 years later, the National Championship in Whanganui had over 1,400 riders representing 82 clubs. Today, BMX still has a strong following. In 2003, the International Olympic Committee even made BMX an Olympic sport, which was played in the 2008 Summer Olympic Games in Beijing, with Marie Strombergs and Anne-Caroline Chalson becoming the first Olympic gold medalists in the sport. After 4 decades, the Masterton course was in need of some TLC, and a group of volunteers, including Wairarapa BMX Club president Kane Harris, spent their spare time upgrading the course for the first time since the late 1990s. Harris is very enthusiastic about the project. "We have had support from many businesses and funding agencies in the region and are now in the stages of the gate rebuild to get the concrete slab poured, and we'll be off and racing once more. So far we have cleared and reshaped and widened the track, new lime, tons and tons of the stuff, planting in a new gate and mechanism. Our game is to get kids on bikes to learn the fundamental skills for BMX as a gateway to better physical and mental health. Some of New Zealand's top riders in the mountain bike and track cycling disciplines got their starts in BMX. Maybe Masterton may have a future Olympian waiting in the suburbs." All right, so that's the first story. Trying to find songs about BMX riding. I've cheated a little bit here. This is actually a cover. This is the one that I heard first. I can't remember. The song is called Ride Like the Wind. I can't remember who did the original, but this is a version by English heavyweight metal band Saxon. So here we are with Ride Like the Wind. Christopher Cross did that song originally, and that one's going out to Ray. Right, next story. This one's slightly longer, so this will take a little bit more. The Masterton Rugby Club was formed in 1876 and featured several different grades. The 3rd 15 in 1909 won their championship, and many of the players would go on to play rugby in the following years. But when hostilities broke out in Europe, the destinies of the players changed. Over half the team would serve in the forces during the war, with seven travelling overseas. Six of these returned, but sadly one did not. Norman Fly enlisted in January of 1917 and headed overseas in April. He did not have a comfortable war and spent most of his time in and out of hospitals and little time at the front. He returned to New Zealand in September of 1919 and worked as a clerk in Masterton and died in 1966. Sidney Dixon was a mechanic before the war. He was one of the first to enlist, signing up in August of 1914. He served with the Wellington Infantry Regiment and saw service in Gallipoli and Europe. By the end of 1918, he had the rank of second lieutenant. He was a carpenter after the war and died young in 1932 from illness. Thomas Rayner was married and had a child when he was called up. He did not meet the fitness requirements to serve overseas, but he did join the service and worked as a clerk in the recruitment office. After the war, he worked as a clerk and then as a traveller. He then shifted to Australia, where he worked as a publisher and lived to an old age. Leslie Johns was one of the later entrants to the war. He had previously been classified as unfit for training, but passed as fit in May of 1918. He began training with the Ambulance Corps, but did not see service overseas. Following his discharge, he worked as a carpenter before he died in 1938. Alfred Pauling sailed overseas in December of 1914 and was with the first Anzac troops that landed at Gallipoli. He had been at the front for just 3 days when he was severely wounded, being shot through the finger, elbow, right arm and leg. He was evacuated to hospital and then back to New Zealand, where he was discharged from the army. On top of being shot and discharged, his set of bagpipes was also stolen. The box meant to contain them arrived back in New Zealand, but it was empty, and no trace of the bagpipes was ever found. After rehabilitation, he worked as a labourer and died in Masterton in 1946 at the age of 54. Sidney Munn was working as a plumber for Pickering Brothers before he signed up as a rifleman with the New Zealand Rifle Brigade. He left for overseas in July of 1918 and remained in England for the next year, returning to New Zealand in June of 1919. He went back to plumbing and kept this profession for the rest of his working life, and he died in 1976. James Hanley also worked as a plumber before the war. He left New Zealand in April of 1917 and September was serving at the front with the Wellington Infantry Regiment. After 2 months, he was admitted to hospital, and he didn't get back to the front until May of 1918. He was promoted to Lance Corporal before the end of the war and sailed for New Zealand in August of 1919. James, too, went back to plumbing after leaving the army and died in 1960. William McCatty signed his attestation in January of 1916 and left for Europe in May. He arrived in England and in July sailed for France the following month. He joined the Canterbury Infantry Regiment and spent the next year at the front, taking leave in the UK in August of 1918. He sailed for New Zealand in March of 1919 and during a trip home was hospitalised. Upon discharge, he went back to cabinet making, the profession he had before the war. He later moved to Petone and died in Lower Hutt in 1975. Seven more of the former 3rd 15 remained in New Zealand for the duration of the war and did not serve in the armed forces. Despite not participating in the conflict, they helped keep the country running during the absence of so many of the country's youth. James Carmine moved to Buller in 1911 and continued to play rugby there, representing the town in several games. He then worked in the railways and received an exemption to serve in the war due to the importance of his job. He lived all over the country, including Waipawa, Featherston, Pātea, and New Plymouth. He lived to an old age and died in 1982. Albert Eddy lived in Lincoln Road and worked as a dispatch clerk after the war. He was called up for the reserves, but this was in September of 1918 and he missed out on active service. By the 1920s, he was living in Tararua Street and working for the postal service. By the 1940s, his profession had changed to clerk and he was now living in Cole Street. He died in 1963. George Yates played rugby for several years after his team won the 1909 championship. He represented Whited Upper in matches and went on to play for Red Star. He retired from club rugby in 1915, marrying the same year. He lived in Reynolds Street and worked as a plumber for the next 4 decades and died in 1964 at the age of 72. Ernest Simonson worked as a fireman during the war in Masterton. By the 1920s, he was living in Seddon Street, Whanganui, working as an engine driver. By 1957, he had retired and lived in Whanganui until his death in 1984. Herbert Billington was working as a farmer before the war. In 1914, he was living in the Waikato and was examined in 1918 to see if he was fit for service. He passed his medical, but due to the end of hostilities in Europe, he did not enter into the army. He continued farming in Waikato until early 1960s, when he went dairy farming at Waiau Pa to the south of Auckland. He died in 1983 at the age of 92. James Dean played rugby for several years after the 1909 championship. He was a member of the Amateur Athletics Club and competed in the events of hurdling, cycling and running. In 1919, was on the team Shop Assistants that played a game of rugby against the Athletic Club. By the 1920s, he had moved away from Masterton. After this, it is difficult to know what happened to him, as there are no fewer than 9 James Deans in the 1928 electoral roll. Horace Simonson was the younger brother to Ernest. He was a coach painter when war broke out and maintained this position throughout the conflict. By 1928, he had shifted to Roskill in Auckland and had moved on to painting cars. By the 1940s, he was listed as a general painter in Onehunga, along with his son, also named Horace. He died in 1962 at the age of 70. One last player would sign up and serve with the New Zealand Forces during the war. Edward Fisher was working at the Masterton Post Office when his team won the third 15 championship. The following year, he moved to Waipukura and then on to Taihape, during which time he also attempted a climb of Mount Ruapehu. He left with the main body of troops in 1914 and landed at Gallipoli on April 25th, 1915. Edward Fisher died 4 days after landing. His body was never found. He has no gravesite, but his name is inscribed on the Lone Pine Memorial, and there is no doubt his memory was kept alive by the other members of the Masterton Rugby Club 3rd 15 of 1909. Trying to find pieces of music on rugby, which I am not afraid to say I'm not a fan of. I don't really like rugby, but I did find this one. It is Australian, but it's about rugby as a whole, so don't hold that against me. He does say the word wallaby, but it is about rugby and the spirit of rugby. So this is John Williamson, A Number on My Back.
When I think of all the men that played, that took the knocks and made the grade, the legends that the game has made, I can't believe I'm here. I'll wear the gold with a sleeve of green. It makes me strong, it makes me keen, and I'll go forward like a steel machine till cracks in the foe appear. Could it be a dream? My father's son, that's me. Humbled by the truth, I am a golden wallaby, and I will seize the day, 'cause it belongs to me. Temper fray, I'll fight until the end, and I will keep a solid chin, 'cause champions don't always win, they're known for coming back again, and we will make amends. Could it be a dream? My father's son, that's me. Golden wallaby, and
John Williamson number on my back. On to our last story already. In 1968, viewers first met Skippy, an eastern grey kangaroo who, with human companions Sonny and Mark Hammond, had adventures at the Waratah National Park, of which the boy's father, Matt, was the head ranger. Each week, the boys and Skippy tackled everything, from thieves and poachers to helping lost and injured people and animals. Skippy was often the hero, jumping off to relay messages or to help with rescuing infant children from floodwaters. She could even operate radios and untie ropes and understood human talk very well. The show ran for 3 seasons and a total of 91 episodes. By the early 1970s, everyone knew who the young bush kangaroo and her catchy theme song. Skippy was among a hero to children, and an opportunity to meet her was a very exciting prospect. Even though the show had ended in 1970, Skippy was still well known by children in 1973. When word got out that Skippy was coming to Masterton, there was great enthusiasm amongst the young. What the wired up of children didn't realise, perhaps, is that there wasn't just one Skippy. The kangaroo that was coming to Masterton was one of a team that were used to film the television show. Anything up to 15 kangaroos were used to film each episode. A bonus for the Skippy fans was that she was bringing her young son along with her. Ever the devout mother, Skippy had been named Mother of the Year the previous year in an Australian magazine, so there was no way she was going to visit New Zealand friends without him. And the name of the Joey? Well, Joey, of course. Skippy and Joey arrived in Masterton on May 8, 1973, and were the star attractions at a series of events at the Town Hall. Also on the bill were Crunch the Clown and Ernest Brisbane the Ventriloquist. Putting in 3 separate shows, Skippy and Joey were joined by their trainer, Australian park ranger Phil Bauer. As Skippy was still feeding Joey, her usual routine was not performed, in which she would produce to Phil his cigarettes and matches. To cap it off, she would then give him $1, which she used to pay for her favourite treat, black jelly beans. Rosemary Brader was able to secure an interview with Skippy for the piece she was working on for the Times Age, but Skippy proved to be quite tight-lipped during their chat. This celebrity was one of those no-comment people and wouldn't say a word. She wouldn't even say who the father was. The interview concluded, much to the relief of Brader, who found the experience difficult. "I was exhausted by the end of the interview, mainly because I'm not used to the hopping." Local children were able to go and meet Skippy and Joey, not just from their seats, but up on stage with her. The opportunity was seized on by many, and 2.5-year-old Michelle Williamson and 9-year-old Jackie Northcott, both from Masterton, were among those lucky enough to share the stage with the Roos. Hundreds got the chance to see Skippy. But it wasn't just the children. Skippy had her share of adult admirers too. After her 3 shows, Skippy, Joey and Phil continued their New Zealand adventure, stopping off in Dannevirke for the night before continuing on to Hastings, much to the delight of their fans, children and adults alike. Well, in terms of kangaroo-y Australian stuff, I have to play this one. See if you know it. And at the end of it, I'll tell you what it is if you're still struggling. It is the theme from Crocodile Dundee. I went through trying to find jokes relating to kangaroos, and I found quite possibly the worst joke about kangaroos. This was one of those ones that if you sort of grew up in the 80s and 90s and you had those little packets of chippies that you would get for your lunch, and on the back of it there'd be a little strip and it would have very bad jokes in it. This was always on there. So I'll say it and I'll pause just so you can try and plumb the depths of your horrible childhood memories of these jokes. What do you get if you cross a sheep and a kangaroo? A woolly jumper. Isn't that bad? But yeah, anyway, I will not be talking to you on Monday. I have next week off on annual leave, so it'll be the next Monday again. So we will see you in 2 weeks' time. Look after yourselves, and we will see you then.